As people finish moving back to their seats, I'll go ahead and give a little bit of an introduction to the organizers of our next session. You heard them referred to several times during the World Bank IFC session. And this is the Safe Water Network. The Safe Water Network takes a long-term integrated approach to demonstrate the potential for new solutions by collaborating with private and public stakeholders, local organizations, public health experts, and local and international providers of technology, services, and funding. Building on this, their recent forum, which I think was in January, called Beyond the Pipe, From Pilot to Scale in India, they're focused on bringing together sector leaders and disseminating lessons learned to the field. And I've been working with them for several years. I think that they are definitely at a leading edge of the sector, looking at viable business models to address some of the issues which came up during the previous discussion. Could the people who are here from the Safe Water Network just raise your hand briefly just so people can identify you and see where you are? One in the back, one in the front. And then we have Charles up here. Thank you. We'll move into this next panel, and the way that we'll do it is I'll do a little bit of an introduction of each one of the speakers, and then I'll let them talk about what it is that they want to talk about. And then we'll have a bit of an interactive session toward the end of the session. The first speaker will be Charles Nimako, and he is the Director of Africa Initiatives at the Safe Water Network. He oversees their current and future Safe Water Network initiatives in Ghana and West Africa. Prior to joining the Safe Water Network, Mr. Nimako was the CEO of PepsiCo Bottler in Ghana and was also a franchise operations manager for East Africa. So without further ado, Charles, if you'll come up here, I think that your presentation's ready. Please welcome Charles Nimako.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning to all of you. As Chris said, my name is Charles Nimako with Safe Water Network. I'm based in Ghana, West Africa. I came to the U.S. last week, went to Los Angeles, came back to Washington, going to New York tomorrow. So honestly, I don't know where I am now. So if I start mixing up names of cities, please bear with me. I'm going to be doing mostly talking. I've put some slides on there just to bring color and picture to the presentation. There will be no words to read on the PowerPoint presentation. That is to force you to look at me and listen to me. Just look at the picture, and then you listen to me. Let me give a brief overview of Safe Water Network, what we do, and what we're doing in Africa. And most of the examples, or almost all the examples, will be coming from Ghana, because that's where I'm based, and that's where most of the activities are happening, in addition to India. I'll show a few examples from India, and then we take it from there. Safe Water Network in Ghana, we are piloting a community-based distributed water system with Water Health International. We funded Water Health International so that we can work together with them to find out, to learn as much as we can from the project and see that if we can find a scale proposition. I mean, the talk today is about achieving operational sustainability, and a lot of it ties into building scale and making the operation, making the sites operationally sustainable. The way we structure the deal in Ghana is that the communities, we have a lot of community involvement. The communities contribute 10% of the capital cost to the sites, and we funded the rest. And Water Health International constructed the site, and they provide operational and maintenance services. Obviously, we charge for the water, and after covering the operational expenses, whatever is left, if there's any, goes to pay for the recovery of capital. And eventually, when the villages and the towns are finished paying for the water, the site becomes theirs, and they can use some of the surplus funds to maintain the site and also replace the equipment at the end of its useful life. This is a typical site in Ghana, constructed by Water Health. And all the sites are like this. They are the same structure, the same technology, making use of river water for treatment. In terms of the challenges and in terms of what we have learned so far after going into this collaboration with Water Health International, I think there are three issues that we've been faced with that we're trying to find solutions to. The first one is that we need to charge enough that we don't turn people away, but just enough to make sure that we cover the operational expenses for the sites. And also, we have some surplus left over to cover the capital recovery and also pay for the replacement of the equipment. And then secondly, I think the ownership of the assets. At the end of the day, when the asset reverts to the communities, how are they going to manage it? Who's going to own it? And what are some of the issues that come along with it? And the third issue is building scale. I mean, we can't make these sites sustainable if you don't build scale to make sure that they are profitable and that we have enough revenues to pay for the expenses and also leave some for the capital recovery. So with these three issues, I think I'll quickly run through them. I've been given 10 minutes to finish this. So I'll quickly run through them and see what are some of the solutions that we've come up with. The first issue is the affordability issue, the pricing issue. As I said earlier on, we need to price these things right, that we don't turn away people, but also to make sure that we charge enough to cover the operational costs of the sites. We have, I think one of the speakers earlier said that in St. Lucia, the pricing has been held constant, except for inflationary increases. I think we have the same issue in Ghana. We started off at a low price. We increased the price about a year and a half ago, and I think we've maintained the same pricing since then. We feel that the pricing is adequate as of now. What we think the main challenges are is bringing more people on to use the sites so that we can have the economies of scale that we are looking for. So we're going to hold, for right now, we're holding the pricing and doing more activities to bring more people to use the sites. What we learn is it's not a case of if you build it, they will come. We have built it, and some people have come, but not enough have come yet. So we're doing programs to bring more people online to make sure that we get the economies of scale that we are looking for. This is another safe water station in India, which is basically run on the same concept. One of the issues we also face, when I said if you build it, they will come, but if you build it and you don't generate the demand, they're not going to come, is that we've learned that convenience and proximity plays a big role in giving access to people. We've looked at villages where we've started mapping out who is using our water and who is not using it. And you find out that as you move further away from the site, the usage drops off quite significantly. And what are we doing to counteract that? There are a couple of things we're doing. One of the things we're doing is that we've introduced a truck delivery system. This is a typical delivery truck at one of the sites. And what this does is it takes the water door to door. And we've looked at the economics of the delivery, and it does make sense because people are willing to pay for the convenience of having the water delivered to their doorsteps. And it's working very well, and it's helping us achieve the scale that we're using for at the sites that we're doing the water deliveries. Aside from the water deliveries, we're also putting together what we call vantage points. That is piping the water from the main treatment center to other parts of the village. Again, talking about the proximity and the convenience and all the things that people demand these days. Rural communities, even though they're rural and not as affluent, they still ask for the same conveniences. And mind you, we are not operating this in a vacuum. There are also people who are operating in these villages and taking water to the consumers, even though the water quality is suspect in most cases. Our objective is to bring safe, clean water to the people. And this is another example of India where we're using motor-driven tricycles, autos, to take water to the villages and to the consumers. We have we're in the process of constructing vantage points, which I was touching on earlier, where we are taking water from the central distribution point from this central distribution point, piping it to convenient centers in other parts of the town to make sure that we get the water, the access, and the convenience to the people that we've been talking about. A bigger part of our work is on demand generation, as I said earlier. Unless we get up to scale and we get up to scale quickly, the whole thing will not be sustainable because you have to generate enough money to make the economics attractive, either for ourselves or for any private sector operator or any bank that we want to bring in, any microfinance partner that we want to bring in the future. So the vantage points are helping, but in addition to that, we're doing the demand generation exercises. And the demand generation is not any different from how you market any consumer product. We do promotions, buy 3 gallons, get one free. We go door to door. We have hired people who go door to door trying to sign up people. And a bigger part of it is also consumer education. I think once you make people aware of the qualities of the water and the benefits of using that water, they will come. Most people will make the right decision to buy the water or come and fetch the water. So consumer education, health and hygiene education is a big part of the work that we do. I think. And as a start for the consumer education and the demand generation and all the demand side activities that we do, I think a key part is mapping who buys our water, who does not buy our water, what are the reasons why they don't buy the water, and what are the other alternatives that they have. As a start, we try to map up the villages. This is one of the typical mapping exercises. And we, at the beginning, we limit it to people who live within 500 meters of our site because we want to understand the people who are in close proximity to the site but are still not using the water before we start going outside into the other parts of the community. And we get some pretty good information from why people are not using the water even though they live very close to the site. And with that, we come up with programs or activities to try to convert them because in most cases, pricing must be an issue. There's switching costs involved. People are getting water free from the river or from the stream, and all of a sudden we want them to pay for the water. So we want to find ways to minimize the switching costs for them. Then after we've done the consumer mapping, as I said, we'll let people go door to door and try to convince them or give them incentives to buy the water from us. The last bit of the activities that we're doing, and I think I'm still within time, is on the health and hygiene education, which is also ties into the quality control issues. I think the health and hygiene and the quality control issues, our colleagues from Bloomberg School at Johns Hopkins, I think they've been coming to Ghana the last several summers. They can attest to the work that we try to do in that segment. The quality control, I think a lot of people maybe find it difficult to tie it to the sustainability, but I think it's pretty straightforward in the sense that if people find out that the water that they're paying for, they're paying extra money for, is not giving them the benefit that they're supposed to derive from it, then eventually they will drop off. So we have to make sure that we produce safe water, we produce quality water, and we let people know what the qualities are in the water for them. One issue that we're having is household recontamination. We will produce water at the site that is clean and safe, but when it gets into people's homes, God knows where they put the water and the type of containers they use for the water. The containers that they use to fetch the water from our sites, we have constructed what you call container wash basins. So when people come in to fetch the water, they get to clean the containers, wash them with soap, sanitize them a little bit before we fill the water for them. We're hoping that this will carry on into the households. Sometimes it's not the case, but most times it's the case. We've also issued dedicated containers at some of the sites where people use those containers, and we encourage them to use them only for water that is purchased from our sites. I think pretty much these are the issues that we're doing. I mean, there's monitoring and evaluation activities that we're doing to understand the usage of our water, who is using it, what do they use it for, why are they not using it. what other sources of water is available for them. But I think these all provide challenges, and these are all the solutions that we are trying to come up with. But at the end of the day, I think to make these activities or to make these sites sustainable and to build a scalable proposition is to make sure that we do all these things to get the economies of scale that we are looking for. Some of the sites are breaking even, others are not breaking even. But we run them as a portfolio, and we use the excess funds from one site to subsidize the funds from the other site. But eventually, based on the programs that we put in place, we're hoping that all the sites will break even, and based on that, we can scale up the proposition. Thank you very much.
Let's take time for one quick question for Charles while we change over to the next presentation. The gentleman right there in the back, Catron.
Hi, Charles. Michael Fields from ITT Watermark. We've worked with Safe Water Network and very familiar with the research that you're doing. I'm interested in the mapping, because mapping who's using your water and why they're using it is one thing, but going to the health issues, are you also starting to map the health problems identified with, say, keeping the water in unsanitary containers in the households? And how are you connecting that? Because that is a very important part. If you just connect the cost, people are not using the water because of the cost is one thing, but if they're not using it because of the cost and then there's still health problems associated with the unsanitary water, how are you guys mapping that, and what research are you doing around that?
Okay. Thank you, Michael. I think what we're doing now is at the basic level, trying to get at as much baseline and basic information as we can. And once we have that data, then we can start putting the health data on top of it. For example, one of the things we plan to do is that we have a local clinic in one of the communities, and we want to work with them based on the data that we have, the households that are using our water, what are the incidence of diseases, and we can put all that data on top of the mapping that we're doing. But at the beginning, we're just trying to identify the universe, identify the customers, and get some basic data about them. And we can pinpoint where they live by GPS technology, and so that we can build that data.
Amanda, you're dying to say something, and I love it when you say things. So please, Catron, if you can give the microphone to Amanda, that'll be absolutely fabulous. This is Amanda Gimbel from the Safe Water Network, for those who don't know her.
Thank you, Chris. Is this on? Okay, great. I just wanted to add to what Charles just said. We have been doing a three-year analysis and study in collaboration with the Johns Hopkins University. We started this work in advance of putting in sort of a baseline study. And it's over 3 years, there's been a socioeconomic and health impact study that's being done to really take a look at what the health, because to your point, Michael, we really need to understand, are we having the desired health impact? We've had interim reports that have come out on this, and we will be sharing the work that is going to be finalized over the next 6 months, should be available in the fall, that Johns Hopkins is coming out with, on looking at precisely this issue of, are we having the desired health impacts?
And it's been wonderful to kind of watch Safe Water Network through those years start out really as a technology focus and really move into exploring and working out the refinements of production and distribution models, demand creation, long-term hygiene promotion, and health impact. So it's wonderful. We'll have plenty of time for more discussion later, but for right now, our next presenter is Al Hammond. He's the co-founder and executive chairman of HealthPoint Services. It's a global company that is refining a disruptive model for delivering high-quality, affordable health care and safe drinking water to low-income rural communities in emerging markets. He is a global leader in base-of-the-pyramid business strategies, and he's a member of the leadership group at Ashoka, the world's largest network of social entrepreneurs. He is also the principal author of this document, which is called The Next $4 Billion, which was a landmark study of bottom-of-the-pyramid markets, and he's published extensively, and we're very, very privileged to have Al with us today. Al?
Just the down key? Great. So I just want to remind everybody that most of the world doesn't have the privilege of taking a sip of water without worrying about health consequences. And that is a situation that none of us find acceptable, and I think it's what brings us all together here. But it is an ongoing, daily, urgent issue for most of the world's people. So we are dealing with a series of problems in India, which are typical for most rural areas of emerging markets, and they include lack of access, informal supply chains, no doctors, and, of course, people collecting their drinking water right where they do their laundry. What we're doing in response to that is building a privately owned healthcare distribution infrastructure. We actually build clinics in rural villages. We spend about $50,000 to build and equip them. They provide access to real doctors through telemedicine. They have full diagnostic laboratories. We do 80 tests at the village level. We have a licensed pharmacy, mostly stocked with generics. And, of course, we do appropriate water treatment for the local area we're in, mostly in northern India. It's reverse osmosis. And, again, very similar to the water health model. People come and pick it up. This is a for-profit social enterprise model. The water points, the standalone ones, which we're building as well as integrated clinics, look like that. They have a distinctive appearance and color. And I should say that my co-founder and partner in India, Amit Jain, was in fact the person who really invented this water model in when he was at the Nandi Foundation working in partnership with Water Health. He has built nearly a third of the water units operating in rural India today. So we have quite a bit of experience at doing this. And what we're seeing is that we can do this sustainably and reliably. All of our water units are now sustainable. And yet our pricing is quite affordable. We're charging essentially a nickel a day for 20 liters. That's $1.50 a month per family on a prepaid subscription basis. And and of course, we have some powerful synergies between water and health. It turns out that because you come and collect your water every day, we have traffic to market healthcare to. And it also turns out that if you have TB or AIDS and you don't want your neighbors asking why you're going to the clinic, you have social cover. I'm going to pick up the water. And there are reverse things because while waterborne diseases are a key problem in every community, they're not the only one. And if we can address the other ones too, then we keep our people healthier so that they, in fact, stay customers. So I want to, having shown you some pictures, I want to then talk a little bit more about the key challenges and what I see as the metrics for success. First, in terms of operational performance, we now know that we can build a water unit in a village of 3,000 people or more, or in a small town, and that it will be sustainable within 3 months. The ones in towns are typically sustainable in the first or second month. We provide a job and a half per each one. We have a water operator that we train, and we have a full-time, a half-time promoter person who goes door-to-door and is part of our social marketing activities. The key success factors, we think, for sustainability are revenue per unit. And you can get there by charging more money or by having more customers. We've actually compared our strategy to that of five other water operators in India, and we are very close to the top in revenue per unit, and the other major player charges more than twice as much for 20 liters that we do. So we're essentially making it up by being better at the second metric, which is market penetration. We typically can achieve 50% of the households to be subscribers to the water service within 3 months. So we have a fairly high penetration metric, which is, in effect, a key social metric. A second thing is the appearance of the facility and the other social marketing things. And I think one of the things that the field has learned over the last few years is that the only thing that people initially have to judge whether your water actually might be safe is the look of the facility where they get it. And so you can see the water health units like ours have a modern, distinctive, clean appearance. That's absolutely and critically important. In addition, of course, we do school programs, door-to-door leafleting, a variety of community events, and a whole range of other social marketing and demand generation and consumer education activities. Finally, I think it's incredibly important about follow-through, and that has to do with testing the quality of your water regularly. We test with an independent laboratory every 2 weeks, and we post those results right where people pick up the water. And over time, people learn to look, what's the dissolved solids? Oh, okay. Right, so it's part of our education. It's also part of our quality promise. The second sort of set of challenges are getting to scale. And for that, you need to raise capital. We invest in a standalone water point, typically about $15,000 for the facility and the RO equipment and piping and tanks and other things we need. And one of the reasons we are structured as a for-profit social enterprise is precisely so we can raise capital in the capital markets. We're also partnering with a major water technology provider so that we can source technology at below market prices. We have a unique global and local management team, which allows us to start scaling in India while we're piloting in Southeast Asia and Latin America, as we are this year. And we have a very focused public sector engagement strategy. We only go where governments want us to go, and we engage them in a number of different ways, but fundamentally, we, in a sense, offer to put up our own capital so that we're independent of government, but then we let them take credit for bringing us there. And then we will work out voucher systems and other things, targeted PPPs that allow us to get clear to the most poorest part of our communities. And as we get a little bit more to scale, we will do that more systematically. And so the last point I would make is that these are difficult problems. They require all the degrees of freedom you can bring to the problem, and that's why Ashoka, where I sit, believes very much in the power of hybrid models, hybrid value chains. And in this case, we have at least two, maybe three examples embedded in our model. One, we are partnered with Ashoka, which incubated this model, and that gives me a global network of fellows as my advisors and market intelligence network when I think about where I go next. Also, it's not incidental that all of my initial funders have deep ties to Ashoka, even though they made their own investment decisions. Secondly, we have announced a partnership with Procter & Gamble, who is interested in safe water. And we are learning from them, and they are learning from us. And in the long run, if this partnership really works out, we are teaching them how to do this successfully after they failed with their pure model as a commercial enterprise, because we think they could take this kind of water model to 40 countries. And it will be a long time before a small startup enterprise could get to that scale. So it's consistent with our social goal, and we're not terribly worried about them competing with us because nobody's going to build a second water plant in a village that already has one. And the number of villages just in India that lack any source of safe drinking water is 200,000. So there's an infinite market. And finally, we are partnering with a NGO that I can't mention just yet to build a containerized version of both the clinic and the model at the water treatment plant that could be built on an assembly line very inexpensively, pre-positioned for disaster relief, and master franchise to entrepreneurs all over the world. So we are quite serious about getting to scale. We've planned for it, And we think, in fact, the key to getting to scale is to plan for it. Thank you very much.
Let me do one thing briefly. Al had referred to their partnership with P&G, and I just wanted to acknowledge, if you could just raise your hand, Greg, just that he has been involved in the water sector for several years now. That's Greg Allgood from P&G. One quick question for Al while I transfer presentations. Right here in front, Katrin, that's a long run for you, so I'll talk while you move, and then you'll be there, and it's perfect.
Perfect timing. Could you please explain what the source of the water is that you're using, and whether it's groundwater or surface water, and how you get permission to use that water? And I could ask the same thing to Charles, too, if you don't mind.
Yeah. We basically use whatever the local water supply is. In northern India, it's mostly a borehole, but sometimes it's also a irrigation canal or a river. And that's why you have to adjust your technology for the needs of that particular source of water. Ultrafiltration is fine if there aren't heavy dissolved solids, and sometimes UV is enough if the water is clean except for fecal contamination. So you have to adjust. In our case, we make a deal with the local government, usually blessed by the district commissioner and by the state government. And that deal is they provide us a 15-year lease on a piece of land central to the village where we can build the unit. They provide us a source of raw water, which is whatever source that they have in that village, and they provide us an electrical hookup because it takes a long time to get that in India if you're not part of the government. We pay the rest.
We pay the rest of the costs, but that, in most cases... But we ask them if they want us to come and invest our money and provide, operate a plant and be there for the long term, then that they need to give us those three things, a lease, source of raw water, and an electrical hookup. We, I think it's interesting to note that although we don't require it, in many cases, local governments, either at the village or at the district level, have been willing to put up part of the money to build the house, the building. So we have actually raised close to a third of our capital from the Punjab government or its subdivisions in the form of in-kind services, namely building the facility that we then equip. And but we don't, as I said, require that. We're willing to put our own money on the ground, and that gives us a... independence that can be quite crucial if you want to maintain the facility in the proper way for the long term.
Some of the words that I said early on about this forward-looking group I think are encapsulated in Al's presentation. It's a new thing to this sector to talk about short-term financial viability, to talk about job creation, market penetration, a quality promise, and access to capital. So I think you're seeing an example of the newness that this panel is bringing to this conversation. That almost makes it perfect to hear next from Doreen Salazar. She comes to us from the U.S. Peace Corps, and she's going to talk about very successful adaptations of the more traditional community management model. It's the more common model, but she's going to talk about some rare long-term successes that Peace Corps has had. Right now, Doreen provides technical support to Peace Corps programs related to water, sanitation, hygiene, promotion, and renewable energy. She served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador. Can people who have been Peace Corps volunteers in the past raise your hands? It's an interesting diminishing number, but we're still there. She also has been working in development since 1998, 3 years as an American Association for the Advancement of Science Fellow, 4 years with USAID Central America Clean Technology Program, 4 years as Programming and Training Officer for Peace Corps Bolivia, and the last 2 years she's been here in Washington, D.C. Please welcome Doreen Salazar.
All right. Okay, well, I was asked. I hope this works. I'm not that tall. Can we get this down? All right. So I was asked to remind folks where the Peace Corps is, since we haven't been so visible in this sector recently. In terms of all the countries where we serve, Peace Corps is currently in 77 countries, pretty much split between our three regions. Volunteer sector areas to which we assign them. As you can see, education is the largest sector, after which is health. Among the health volunteers, there are 51 health projects. 12 of those are specifically focused on water sanitation, and the remainder health projects can support water sanitation, but on a household level and on the hygiene behavior change side. Uh-oh. I'm pressing the wrong buttons. Okay. No, that's not the right one. Okay. We're good. Okay, so we've been tracking outcomes for the last 3 years. We're doing better at tracking our outcomes. And so what we reach is about 100,000 people a year with water sanitation, with water, and about a third that with the sanitation side. Ooh, I'm doing this again. Don't do that. I can do this. And what we have are about 350 volunteers that are assigned to water sanitation and another 100 or so volunteers that will find themselves doing water and sanitation as a secondary project because they see a need in their community. And the hygiene promotion side, you'll get all of our health and water sanitation volunteers looking at that, and these are celebrations around Global Handwashing Day. Ooh, I keep doing this. Stop that. Got to keep my finger in the right place. Okay. So I will be talking about two things. One is in the Dominican Republic, as with many water sanitation programs, there's not a whole lot of effort, even within Peace Corps, to go back and look at how are these things working. So I figured since this was a panel talking about operational sustainability, the success that our folks down there, our team in Dominican Republic, had reported going back to systems that had been installed 15 years ago and set into place was a good one to highlight. And then I'll also be talking about circuit rider models that have been promoted in various places. Okay, so this particular set of water committees and water systems that the team in Dominican Republic looked back at was around a community in Altamira. They called a committee of committees to bring them all together and discuss how they were doing, what their challenges were. And what they found as they visited and talked with these communities is that of the 35 committees that participated in the forum, all of the 35 committees are continuing to function. They found ways to replace their personnel and retrain folks over that period of time. They're all collecting tariffs. They're all able to maintain at least enough financial sustainability for operating their systems. And some of them actually have amassed funds and are able to expand their systems. Many of them have maintained their systems. One community gathered as much as $2,800, and these are with tariffs of averaging $1 a month per family. So that's not a whole lot, but they were able to collect those funds over time. So those are the success aspects of this. Oh, excuse me. And I asked them, well, what contributed? What made these particular committees so successful that they continue to operate over time? And these are more generic, but basically the local ownership, the local commitment. In the case of the Dominican Republic, the communities were asked to set a committee in place, begin charging tariffs before we even went to the community, before we ever entered to start a project in the communities. So they definitely had to show a level of commitment and organization before they even got started. Same thing, the economic sustainability, they looked at that before they got started and not as an afterthought. Sustainable social institutions, this happened both at an informal and a formal level. I asked them, well, you know, why aren't there transparency issues or did you see that? And apparently there's enough of a network and these are small enough communities that we work in. Peace Corps is typically in communities of 50 to 300 families, so it's much smaller. You wouldn't be able to reach the economies of scale that you saw in some of these other models our previous presenters looked at. But there was some social networking with an agricultural extension agent or with doctors or others who visit various communities, enough of social pressure that we're going to keep you folks honest, and enough respect for our water sanitation person who, you know, had such a presence that even the respect for his presence and for demanding that the communities met certain parameters worked in terms of establishing certain parameters. Now, the volunteers also are very strong with local capacity building, with behavior change. We're incorporating that in the hygiene work that we do, and so that building of local capacity to maintain their system certainly also helped with these systems to continue working. Going back to that, there have, of course, and we all know this, are some challenges with these local water systems. And those challenges would be, one, sustained water quality. The water quality was tested early on, but there's been no testing ever since their installation of whether that water quality has maintained itself. In the case of the Dominican Republic, there are systems that are spring captations with some control of contamination so that it doesn't get contaminated in the watershed, but is that water quality holding? We don't even know. The other one is just in terms of maintaining efficiencies in the system and no water waste. There certainly are cases where a family might receive water only 2 hours a day and another family is getting a lot more. There are broken valves or whatnot, and these are not always repaired. Lack of technical capacity, particularly to address some of the more larger issues of river crossing came down or something. There's not always the local technical capacity to be able to address those issues. And then, you know, in other systems there still is the transparency. Who holds these folks accountable? In Honduras, looking back at the systems, I talked with our manager there, and similar issues in Honduras, similar issues with the systems. He was very impressed because after Hurricane Mitch, about 80% of the rural water systems had some kind of failures. They had stopped functioning, and for majority of these, the local water committees were able to get their systems back up and running without support from the overtaxed public support systems. So he saw this as a sign of success. Unfortunately, this has also meant that those rural water committees in Honduras are reluctant to spend their funds on chlorine because they need them for the next disaster. So there's a downside to that. So the challenges that these systems face can often be alleviated, with some kind of support system. And a circuit rider model that has been successful here in the United States with the National Rural Water Associations, this model works whereby folks, their task is to go out and visit rural water systems and provide technical assistance and training to ensure that those continue to operate with quality. So the circuit rider model from the United States was piloted in Honduras. I actually did an evaluation of that, how that program was running back in 1997. And my biggest concern at that time was, okay, this seems to be sustaining these systems, but it's 100% funded by the United States Agency for International Development. So I asked my program manager, what's going on there in terms of sustainability and continued service of circuit rider systems? And it turns out in Honduras, they've actually evolved this quite a bit. The organization that at that time was funded by USAID, SANA, the National Rural Water Association, still has retained one circuit rider for each of its 8 regions. There are also municipal associations of juntas de agua that are operating, and they also provide support on the municipal level. There are regional associations of these water committees, and there's a national association of water committees. And it seems to me that the information about the National Association of Water Committees is the most successful in terms of sustainability because it collects a fee from the water associations. It's a nominal fee. That's not a whole lot. But it also is providing chlorine, regional chlorine services, because one of the regions that the local water committees aren't chlorinating is because it's far away to access chlorine. So they're providing chlorine and selling that chlorine and gaining some income from that. They're also selling consulting services, training, and building and repairing water systems. So at least a portion of their funds are generated from income. And as you can see, just in terms of the fees that are being charged by local water committees, it's much more, in both cases of Honduras and Dominican Republic, they've gone up. 15 years ago, they might be happy with charging a few cents. And now they're up to, no, we do need to charge at least $1 per month per family and up to $6 in Honduras for pumped systems. So I think setting a model of a public system that is more towards a private sector model, I think it reinforces, it enables the public sector to do better, but it also provides space for private sector that might be more competitive on that same scale as you were talking about. Okay, so these circuit riders, the example there, ADEC is an NGO that's also, there's several NGOs operating in Honduras. One of them, this is the ADEC, is an NGO that has a circuit rider program in one region of Honduras. And what do these circuit riders do? They support sub-regional, these chlorine suppliers, so they're actually supporting some private sector suppliers. They're training water boards, training plumbers, creating operation and maintenance manuals, and also helping support the continued hygiene education. Circuit rider systems and these associations of associations can also help with benchmarking of the different local water committees, so that they're looking at how much are you charging, how are you maintaining your water quality. And I think that benchmarking certainly helps these different groups to improve their water quality because they don't want to be lagging behind, and providing some kind of water quality testing. Our folks in the Dominican Republic are looking at working with the Institute for the Instituto Nacional de Recursos Hídricos, so their National Water Resources Association, will be helping them with doing some water testing of these systems and then getting back to those communities and seeing what needs to be done to clean up that water quality. So definitely looking at periodic testing of water quality and technical assistance to them, and maintaining some kind of accountability of these systems as well. Okay, just a couple more photos and I'm done. Just examples of different things we do, and including one of the things that our volunteers are doing, because we tend to fill a niche where other organizations are not reaching. These are very, very rural communities. Sometimes those access to those piped gravity flow water systems is very difficult, so we also promote some rainwater catchment. You can see that example in a school down there, and then something on the chlorination side as well. So that is enough for my presentation, keeping it to the 10 minutes.
Thank you, Doreen. Quick question for Doreen. Yes, right over there, Katrin. Thanks.
Brian Banks with Global Water Challenge. I was just wondering about the circuit riders. What type of organization? You said in some cases the water board has them for each district. Are there other models that you've seen of circuit riders that are successful, or other forms of organization among them?
Yeah, in terms of, I mean, circuit rider models are pretty much successful in that they help increase the extent to which the rural water systems are working. But if you say successful in terms of economically successful and not 100% financed by donors, then it's less so. And I suppose you could argue that national governments, regional governments, local governments should be contributing to these circuit rider systems. That's part of their role. So you wouldn't expect them to be 100% financially sustainable. Some kind of subsidy is appropriate. I was very interested to talk with our program manager in Honduras because he was talking about circuit rider programs, one with a national governmental organization, and they're successfully doing it. There are NGOs that are successfully doing these circuit rider programs. There are regional associations, and then there's this national Association of Rural Water Associations, AHASA, in Honduras, which is also has some circuit rider programs going. So they're all very successful in terms of going back to those water systems and also beginning to have, even in Honduras, the compilation of data on where these water systems currently stand is up to date in certain areas, but it's up to 5 years out of date in other areas. So even as serving the role of keeping that information accurate so that we know what's going on is another role that these circuit rider type programs can play. In Panama, we're going to be piloting a circuit rider model there. We haven't found a partner organization with which to work, so basically our volunteers are going to be demonstrating what the benefits of a circuit rider model can be. But yes, being able at least to go back and see what the sustainability is of these small water committees and providing them with the support they can need to improve their operation.
And we had earlier discussions about water user associations, and I think what you heard from Doreen is a bit of a different model that has proven to be apparently sustainable over time. I have one quick question. Sam Houston, you were a volunteer in the Dominican Republic when?
2002 to 2004.
And so these things are operating. You went back and did the check this year. And the only thing that I wanted to raise there is just the issue of time, that these things can work, but they do require the consistency of operation that I think Peace Corps has been able to do in these two locations. So I just wanted to raise that point. On to the next presentation, which will be by Tony Kolb. Tony is the Urban Health Advisor, so we're going to look at urban system operational sustainability. He's the Urban Health Advisor for the U.S. Agency for International Development. His primary focus is supporting USAID country missions in improving and expanding health activities among the urban poor and integrating field experience from those efforts into agency best practices. His 25-year career has included work with the United Nations, bilateral donors and NGOs in over 20 countries in Asia, Africa, and the former Soviet Union on health and environmental policy, research and development. Tony, please come up.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you to Safe Water Network for the invitation to join this panel. I just bumped into a Safe Water Network member who happens to be a former classmate of mine in Kenya, who's by circumstance was sort of a Dr. Livingston, I presume, experience out in a small town in Kenya. Very happy to meet him and happy to know more of that family. The photograph here is actually from a Safe Water Network-supported facility in Ghana, run by Water Health International. And I can tell you later why I chose this photo. But let me talk to you a little bit first about what USAID has been doing recently in Africa on the urban water supply side and some of the criteria that I use when looking at these programs to judge their success. Of late, there's been a reinvigorated amount of programming going into USAID WASH programming in Africa, motivated by the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act and some earmarking that was associated with that since 2008, which specifically emphasized development-oriented investments in Africa in particular. As a result of that, there's been a number of contracts and grants that have been awarded in the last couple of years. Two of those I'm currently managing, one with Water Sanitation for the Urban Poor, a UK-based group, which is working in five countries, and CHF International. Both these grants are orientated towards community-level engagement as a strong part of what they do, but also linking those communities to the water service providers in their cities, at least attempting to. Suwasa is a contract that we have actually with Chris's company, Tetra Tech, based in Nairobi, and is working in a number of countries in Africa, mainly focused on utility-oriented efforts which have positive outcomes for the urban poor. I guess that's the blandest way I could describe it. It's a contract that's just getting going, and there'll be a lot of experience from their efforts in the next couple of years. The photo down in the bottom corner there is from southern Sudan, one of the countries that I've been traveling to frequently over the years. And again, we can mention Sam Houston. That's part of Sam's work down there when he was working with us as WASH advisor in the city of Juba. So that program is an example of USAID building actually major infrastructure. We do that in a number of countries. Most of the countries that we are involved in heavily in reconstruction efforts, and I would include Sudan as one of those. We do that sort of investment. Suwasa, technical assistant, WASUP and CHF, sort of technical assistance and community engagement. I would characterize those three types of approach as some of the key areas. Of course, we're working with Koch in a number of countries more along these lines of what WASUP and CHF are doing, not so much building large infrastructure. In terms of the key characteristics that I'd like to emphasize, I put up the scalability challenge, but it's also the sustainability challenge. They're somewhat linked, I guess, in many different ways. Affordability, safety, and probably the most important one and most complicated one is this sense of accountability. Affordability is fairly straightforward. people in urban areas typically pay for water. There are typically very few free sources of water in denser urban areas. And what the reality is for around the world is most poor people pay the most compared to their better-off neighbors in the town because of the way infrastructure decisions are made. They're typically not on the grid, gaining water from very affordable sources, and so have to pay premium prices for vended water of different kinds. Or they spend a lot more time, and time equals money in an urban setting, waiting to collect water from public sources. I'm not a really good numbers person, although I was trained as an engineer. Sometimes I just sort of, I like the conceptual thinking. But numbers are important, especially when you're poor and making decisions about that very limited amount of money that's in your back pocket. So, Al, you said you're selling water at about a nickel for 20 liters. That's a fairly typical price for vended water systems around the world. It's equivalent to what a lot of kiosks that have water from a pipe network are actually selling typically. But it's $2.50 per cubic meter, which is about 10 times the cost of what somebody with a piped connection to your typical water utility would pay. That 25 cents per cubic meter is sort of around the sustainability tariff in most water systems. 10 times. That's a lot. And why do they need to pay that? That's the sort of big question. And they shouldn't in many respects, because we know that we can provide 25 cents per cubic meter in many settings. And overcoming that affordability challenge and getting towards that price point, which is sort of affordable for many, many people, is where we want to be. Safety, I think that's fairly straightforward. But accountability goes to the institutions around which water service is organized. And, again, it's a very complicated question. But simply moving towards more accountable systems is generally what sustains things over time. A customer orientation in the approaches is extremely important. That's a photo from the water utility main office in Nairobi. I was very impressed that they had if they actually check what people put into their customer suggestion box, that's another question, and what they do with that information, of course. But the simple fact that they have it is pretty neat. A final slide to, again, sort of reemphasize my personal views. These solutions are actually from a slide on sanitation that I prepared. But I think in some respects the principles still apply. We go wrong in development when we force technologies on people and we sort of make decisions that we feel are the right thing for them. Again, trained as an engineer, I appreciate the design process, and it's not easy, and it's sometimes very expensive and difficult to come up with tailored solutions. But tailored solutions are what the urban poor, and I think the rural poor as well, need. They don't need cookie-cutter solutions and one-size-fit-all solutions. That's a very dangerous approach. We need to understand our customers. We need to understand the costs associated with water service and minimize those costs and deliver a product to people that they really are willing to pay for and want without assuming that, we have to build demand before we can actually be successful. We should probably understand that demand first and try to start working towards meeting that demand as a starting point. And well, I'll leave it there for now.
A brief question for Tony. Tony, you stumped them? No questions at all?
There's a question here.
Oh, perfect. Go ahead, Al.
So, Tony, does USAID have an affordable solution for rural communities? Peri-urban, I understand. You can do piped. But in rural, you're not going to build a chlorine plant in a rural village. So do you have a solution for that other than the kind of cookie-cutter solutions that some of us are deploying?
Well, the solutions are again, it depends on if you're in a very wet tropical area with, like, the Dominican Republic and many Latin American countries would have springs that can be tapped, essentially clean water that just needs to be transported to the people that want to use it, to a desert area where maybe rainwater catchment is the only solution and you need some sort of treatment afterwards. No, I mean, you have to come in. There is no one technology. There are books written on water supply, and there are degrees given that people study for 4 years to gain the skills to be able to find those appropriate solutions. So, yes, there's many appropriate solutions that are much less costly than the sort of technology reverse osmosis. I mean, I know of no equivalent. I mean, it's always good to look at these technologies and see how they've been adapted and used over time in developing country, in resource-rich settings. And I don't know of a similar sort of business model to the one that you're proposing that exists in North America or Europe, for example. Reverse osmosis is certainly used and was developed in these countries for largely industrial purposes where very clean water needs to be produced. And there's and or mineralization problems that can't be addressed with other treatment technologies. But what I was trained when I studied reverse osmosis as an engineer was that it's fairly complicated and it's very expensive compared to other treatment methods.
Yeah, that used to be true until the patent on the Dow membranes expired and manufacturing moved to Asia.
Yeah.
And now it's actually one of the cheapest water treatment technologies that's available.
Well, I would disagree with that, but I think just lessons from the sector where markets don't exist for spare parts, technologies tend not to be successful, and that's even true with very simple technologies like hand pumps. I mean, we struggle in many of our countries to develop the market for parts, very easy, sometimes easily locally manufactured ones. And unless there's a market and availability of reverse osmosis spare parts within the Indian submarket, your business is going to have some challenges to be really a scalable solution.
Yeah, there's no shortage of availability of parts for reverse osmosis or ultrafiltration or many other things. Those are now pretty much global markets, and you can buy them by the container load.
Your microphone.
They said there's no shortage of suppliers for reverse osmosis parts and replacement filters and pumps and ultrafiltration techniques and UV things. These are pretty much global markets now, and you can buy them by the container load from many sources. The real problem is the accountability one that Tony pointed to. Somebody has to be in charge of getting them where they go. That's where volunteer systems, in my view, tend to break down, or sometimes even donor-funded systems tend to break down, and where a private sector entity can, in fact, more reliably deliver those spare parts. so that's the argument. In fact, in northern India, we have such high fluorides that RO is almost the only technology that will work with unsafe levels of fluorides in the water.
And this is one of the wonderful points of advancement between what we have known and where the sector is going in the future. So please, a round of applause for this panel. I think they were just terrific.